Imagine a Wall Street CEO gets caught embezzling company funds, right? And he's told he's going to be fired by the end of the week.
Okay. Pretty bad situation for him.
Exactly. So on his way out the door, while he still has system access, he just hacks into the mainframe and completely wipes out the massive debts of his biggest external clients.
Oh, wow. So just blatant theft.
Yeah, he knows it's blatant theft, but he's betting that those clients will be so grateful, they'll offer him a cushy consulting job on Monday morning. Now, imagine Jesus of Nazareth looking at that guy and saying to you and me, be more like him.
It completely shorts out our modern moral circuitry. We are so accustomed to reading ancient texts, especially scriptural ones, and expecting these neat, tidy, easily digestible moral lessons.
Right, like an Aesop's fable or something.
Exactly. But often the texts are intentionally designed to be disruptive.
Disruptive doesn't even begin to cover it, honestly. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are tackling one of the most notoriously confusing and honestly scandalous passages in the New Testament.
The parable of the dishonest manager from Luke chapter 16.
That's the one. Have you ever read something in the Bible and thought, wait, did Jesus really just say that? Because our mission for you today, drawing from some incredibly insightful source analysis, is to unpack the hidden layers of this really difficult teaching.
And we're going to look at it strictly from a Christian perspective.
Right. We need to figure out how a story about a literal unapologetic crook is somehow supposed to relate to our daily struggles with obedience to God.
Well, to even begin applying this to the concept of obedience, we have to establish a crucial distinction right up front. The text demands that you separate the manager's morality from his methodology.
Okay, morality versus methodology.
Right. A close reading of the original language makes it very clear that the master in the story, and by extension Jesus, is not praising the man's fraud.
Okay, good. That would be a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah, the praise is directed entirely at his foresight, at his shrewdness.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if we want to understand what's actually going on, we have to step out of the 21st century and understand the mechanics of first century Palestine.
So in the ancient agrarian economy, a wealthy landowner with vast estates would not manage the day-to-day operations himself. He would employ a manager.
Gotcha.
And the Greek text refers to this role as an oikonomos. This is critical to understand because the oikonomos wasn't just, you know, a low-level clerk or an administrative assistant.
So he's got some real power.
Immense authority. He effectively held full power of attorney to act on the master's behalf. He was out there negotiating deals, collecting rents, and managing these massive localized debts.
And these debts weren't just a few silver coins here and there, right? We are talking about commodities.
Massive quantities of commodities. The text specifically mentions huge measures of wheat and olive oil, which were basically the backbone of the economy back then.
Right. So the manager was essentially the chief operating officer of a sprawling agricultural conglomerate.
Exactly. But then a crisis hits. The landowner receives a report that this COO is squandering the assets. He is mismanaging the wealth.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So the master summons him, demands an audit of the account books, and just fires him on the spot.
And this is the key detail. The termination hasn't gone public yet. He's been given his notice, but he still has the ledger.
Right. He still has that window of access.
And he has this internal monologue where he completely panics. Yeah. He realizes, and I quote, I am not strong enough to dig and I am ashamed to beg.
That monologue is the absolute pivot point of the narrative. He evaluates his options. You know, he realizes manual labor is out of the question physically and the social shame of begging on the street is just unbearable to him.
Desperation sets in.
Yeah. And that desperation breeds a highly calculated survival scheme. Before the wider community finds out he is unemployed, he rapidly summons his master's debtors one by one.
Oh, man.
He sits down with the merchant who owes a massive amount of oil and basically instructs him to quickly slash the bill in half.
He is literally short selling his boss's assets on his way out the door.
It is undeniable corporate fraud. I mean, he is buying the loyalty of these local merchants using his boss's money.
And his motivation is purely self-serving, right?
100%. He knows that when the news of his firing finally breaks and he is officially out on the street, these merchants will feel indebted to him. They'll welcome him into their homes.
So the master finds out about this final parting scam, and he commends the guy.
He does.
Which forces a really uncomfortable question. What exactly is shrewd about this that we are supposed to be analyzing?
Well, the master recognizes the sheer brilliance of the survival tactic. I mean, Yes, he was robbed, but he tips his hat to a maneuver that was incredibly forward-thinking.
He's like, I hate you, but I respect the play.
Exactly. The manager saw an impending, inescapable disaster, his termination and destitution, and he used the very limited time and resources he had left in his current reality to completely secure his future reality.
So the master praises his shrewdness, not his theft. But I mean, applying a crook's shrewdness to daily spiritual obedience still seems like a massive canyon to cross. How does the text bridge that gap?
There is a classic philosophical framework happening here that the source material really highlights. Jesus is employing a fortiori argument.
A fortiori.
Right. It's a Latin term for arguing from the lesser to the greater. The idea is if a specific principle holds true in a lesser flawed scenario, it should logically be exponentially more true in a greater perfect scenario.
Meaning if this incredibly flawed, desperate cook can figure out how to be strategic about his future, shouldn't people who actually have the light of truth be doing it infinitely better?
Yes, exactly. And what's fascinating here is the piercing observation Jesus makes about human nature in verse 8.
Yeah.
He observes that the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light.
Wow.
Yeah. The sons of this world being those who operate entirely within the bounds of this temporary life, the sons of light being believers.
The tragedy of that observation is just heavy. People who have zero belief in an afterlife, the sons of this world, are incredibly strategic, passionate, and calculating about securing their temporary future.
They play their temporary game flawlessly. I mean, just look at the manager.
And on the flip side, believers who claim to have an infinite timeline are often completely passive and unstrategic about eternity. It really makes you evaluate normal behavior.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about it. You will see people spend dozens of hours researching the absolute best earthly retirement accounts. They will compare 401ks, analyze compound interest, read quarterly reports on mutual funds.
Stressing over maximizing a return for a retirement that might last, what, 20 years?
Right. But they put zero strategic thought into an eternal impact. We are aggressively shrewd about age 65, but stumbling in the dark when it comes to eternity.
The conviction of the passage rests right there. If a lesser man, a literal scoundrel, can look ahead and leverage his master's temporary resources to secure a comfortable temporary retirement,
then the greater man should do more.
Exactly. The greater man, a child of God, should be infinitely more strategic with the resources they've been given to secure an eternal impact.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if we are going to translate that wake-up call into practical obedience, it requires a total psychological teardown of how we view our possessions.
It really does. It requires moving from an ownership mentality to a stewardship mentality.
Yeah.
The manager in the story never suffered from the illusion of ownership. He knew the wheat and the olive oil were not his.
Right. He was just moving them around.
Exactly. And the source analysis emphasizes that modern believers must adopt this exact same psychological framework regarding every single thing they possess. Bank accounts, real estate, vehicles, even career skills.
See, they're not owned, they are managed.
Right.
Imagine the psychological relief of realizing you aren't the CEO of your own wealth. I mean, when you believe you are the owner, you inherently take on the anxiety of protecting the hoard.
Oh, absolutely. You have to defend it, grow it, insulate yourself with it.
But if you realize you are just a branch manager carrying out headquarters orders, the burden of ownership just evaporates. You are God's asset manager. The wealth is only temporarily entrusted to you to deploy for the king's agenda.
And this completely redefines the concept of obedience.
How so?
Well, obedience is frequently reduced to passive avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just trying really hard not to sin.
Just keeping your head down.
Right. But viewing this through the lens of stewardship reveals that obedience is active asset management. It is waking up and acknowledging that the capital in your checking account is provided by God and he expects a return on that investment.
But, and this is a big good, but if we are just asset managers, how exactly does headquarters want the capital deployed? Because the text follows the parable with a command that sounds incredibly counterintuitive.
Yes, it instructs believers to, quote, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth.
I have to push back on that phrasing. Unrighteous wealth sounds inherently dirty.
It does sound sketchy.
Yeah. If the goal is pure obedience to God, how are you supposed to juggle something the text itself labels as unrighteous without it corrupting that obedience? It sounds like trying to use cartel money to fund a soup kitchen.
That's a great analogy. The terminology is definitely jarring until you look at the underlying Greek word, which is often translated as mammon.
Okay.
When the text calls it unrighteous wealth, It is not suggesting that physical coins or digital bank balances are inherently evil or radioactive. Money is an amoral mechanism.
It's just paper or code?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The designation unrighteous signifies that money is inextricably tied to this fallen, temporary world system. It is the currency of a broken age.
Okay, I see. It's a temporary tool for a temporary world. It isn't inherently evil, but it operates within a flawed system.
Precisely. And because of its temporary nature, the strategy shifts completely. Since you must live in this world and handle this temporary currency, you are commanded to leverage it.
Leverage it for what?
You use worldly money to advance the gospel, support the local church, and care for the marginalized, the orphans and the widows. By doing this, you are fulfilling the command to make friends.
And those friends being the people who are impacted eternally because of that generosity.
Yes. They are the ones who hear the gospel or receive care because the asset manager deployed the funds strategically.
Wow.
The source actually compares this mindset to a day trader managing a stock portfolio. A day trader does not passively let capital sit dormant.
No, they're constantly moving it.
They aggressively watch the market, look for the best margins, and move capital to where it generates the highest return on investment. Believers are called to view their charitable giving and generosity with that exact same intensity, seeking the maximum eternal return on investment.
So what does this all mean? We've talked about these grand, sweeping kingdom investments, but daily obedience isn't usually found in dramatic million-dollar checks. It's usually found in the friction of incredibly mundane tasks.
That is so true. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Jesus grounds this high-level investment strategy in the gritty reality of daily life in Luke 16.10.
Which says what, exactly?
The text states, whoever is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and whoever is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much.
It really reframes something as mundane as an expense report at work or a tax return.
Completely. The human tendency is to compartmentalize. We construct this spiritual life that happens during a Sunday service and then a totally separate secular financial life that happens on a Tuesday afternoon spreadsheet.
Guilty as charged, honestly.
Right. But this text shatters that division completely. It suggests that administrative tasks and daily budgeting are actual real-time metrics of spiritual allegiance. It is a spiritual litmus test.
That basically eliminates the idea of secular money altogether. If you are debating whether to write off a dinner on your taxes that wasn't actually a business expense, you aren't just making a financial calculation. You are sitting for a spiritual exam.
And this raises an important question presented in the text. If God cannot trust a person to manage a temporary earthly resource like money with absolute integrity, why would he entrust them with true riches?
And true riches refers to what?
Spiritual authority, leadership, influence, and eternal rewards. It suggests a direct causal link.
Right. If someone is willing to fudge the numbers on a $50 expense report, they are telegraphing to headquarters that they lack the integrity required to manage actual eternal capital.
The way a person handles the smallest, most easily overlooked financial details is the clearest possible indicator of their heart's true allegiance. Every financial decision, no matter how small, becomes an act of worship or an act of rebellion.
It really elevates budgeting from just basic math to a demonstration of faithfulness. And that buildup leads to the ultimate ultimatum that closes out this entire teaching. All this tactical advice about money forces a binary choice.
It does. The teaching concludes with one of the starkest lines in Scripture. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money.
There is no middle ground, no dual citizenship allowed when it comes to who sits on the throne of your heart. You either serve God or you serve wealth.
And the contrast with the dishonest manager is intentional here. The manager served money. It was his ultimate security and his master.
And because he served money, he used people to get it. He manipulated merchants and stole from his employer.
Exactly. The righteous path of obedience flips that completely serve God and use money to bless people.
You know, viewing this entire parable through the lens of stewardship is deeply liberating. It completely removes the paralyzing pressure of endless worldly accumulation.
It really takes the weight off.
It does. You don't have to win the rat race because you realize you aren't running on that track anymore. You are playing a completely different game with a completely different currency for a kingdom that actually lasts.
You step out of the anxiety of hoarding and into the freedom of deploying.
I love that. We started this deep dive with a story about a first century crook that felt completely backwards. A master praising a fraudster. But by separating the man's morality from his brilliant forward-thinking methodology, the text reveals a masterclass on managing God's assets.
It's a profound shift in perspective.
We moved from ancient corporate embezzlement to the profound realization that our daily financial habits, our 401ks, our tax returns, our quiet generosity are the literal front lines of our spiritual obedience.
And as we close out, there is one final existential detail from the text for you to mull over. When instructing believers to use unrighteous wealth to make friends, the text gives a specific timeline. It says, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings.
Notice the phrasing there.
Yes. Notice it says when it fails, not if.
The failure of worldly wealth is presented as an absolute certainty.
Every earthly bank account, every currency, every physical asset will eventually fail. It will fail through economic collapse, hyperinflation, or simply because our earthly lives end and we cannot transfer a single penny across the threshold of eternity.
The money will just cease to matter.
Exactly. So the question to evaluate this week is this. Look at your bank statement. Look at where your assets are currently deployed. When this money inevitably fails, who is going to be waiting in an eternal dwelling because of those transactions?
Have you used the master's temporary resources to secure an eternal welcome? That changes everything about how you look at a dollar bill. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We started with a scandalous, confusing parable, and hopefully we've extracted a clear, challenging vision for what daily obedience actually looks like. Keep questioning the surface level, keep analyzing the text, and keep seeking those aha moments. We'll catch you next time.